My talk, Promises, Lies, and Dry Run Mode. Who here uses config management tools? Yeah? Not everybody? Oh, all right. Okay, so let's talk in the past. I'm a career systems administrator. Until a couple years ago, they didn't really let me out much because, you know, I had systems to admin. But I was a Usenix paper junkie. This is my third Usenix event. Went to the 2007 security one in Boston, Lisa this year, and now this. So I'm here to assure you that the papers that you guys publish and put out are actually read by people in the world. So continue to do that, and thank you. So we have this config management tool. It's called Chef. We have a bug tracking system. We use Jira. And one of the earliest tickets that was made in here was Chef ticket number 13. Okay. And ticket number 13, I'm going to illustrate. I'm basically going to show you the narrative of ticket number 13 using cats. So it starts out like this. Somebody files a ticket and says, hey, can we have dry run mode? CF Engine has dry run mode, Puppet has dry run mode. We'd like it in Chef. And so we said, no, you cannot have dry run mode. And then the reply to that ticket was, you know, but come on, man, we really, really, really want dry run mode. To which we replied, no, you can't have it because of science. And to which they replied, but come on, give us dry run mode. No dry run mode. And then they kept asking, and finally we said, fine, you can have dry run mode. Right. But why were we so resistant to actually to do this, right? And we had people even going around, you know, selling competing products, saying like, we have dry run mode, you know, and we're like, ah, Jesus. So, right. So let's talk about how our tools actually work just for a second. I was actually kind of glad to hear some people on the mic earlier asking questions admit that they are not experts in configuration management, which is kind of cool because I was expecting to walk into, you know, a room full of people that knew more than I did. Maybe most of you might actually know more than me, but so if you actually read these papers that come out of Usenix, they talk about this, right? Set of convergent operators, right? This is all the early CF Engine work. Everything Mark published 20 years ago is full of this stuff, right? Like, he writes papers in LaTeX and everything. But you see constantly and repeatedly discussions about these convergent operators, right? And that's kind of what powers all of a certain class of tool. And the way these things work is they're little functions that do a check against something on the system, right? So does this file look this way? Does, you know, this process running? Is this package installed? Is this user here? Whatever. Whatever the check is. And it checks it, and then it takes an action to fix it if it's broken, right? Just to recap. So it looks like this. So all convergent operators under the hood are basically this. Right? Test, take an action. Test, take an action. Test, take an action. And I really like to personify things. It helps me think about problems. So I actually imagine an army of little Lego guys, like constantly running around doing tests and then like spinning around in loops to like kind of like try to crystallize the system into a state and then help fix it when it becomes broken, drifts away, and then you know, it gives you a change management vector for actually applying new policy and changing the state of the system. So I actually imagine Lego people, so that's me. But if we look through the crop of tools that we have, we see similarities in all of them, right? So very, very often within a Linux distribution especially, you'll see certain patterns, right? So So this is the package config file service pattern that you often see. This is an example from bconfig 2. And you'll notice that it's declarative, right? So you're declaring things about the system. I declare this package needs to be here. I need to declare, you know, services running. And then we walk through some more of the tools, right? Here's some CF engine policy, right? And so what you end up with is, you know, like, okay, you have some variables, and I have their, you can think about them as these little Lego guys, right? And then I have packages that are saying, like, all right, well, like, let's make sure that these packages are installed, spin around over and over again. And then processes constantly fixing the state. So we have a set of these convergent operators, right? They always get spat out in a sequence. Whether or not the ordering is actually important or not is a different topic. Here's a hint, it is, except for when it isn't. And then we'll look at other tools, right? Here's Puppet. No, it does the same thing. It's generating a set of these convergent operators, right? And how the sequence is ordered is kind of like, a user interface difference between the tools, right? You know, like CF Engine does normal ordering. I'm not really sure how bconfig does its ordering, but I aim to find out before I leave. Puppet, you build this graph and sorts it. Chef, you just imperatively like define the sequence, right? You just say what you want the sequence to be, and then it spits it out, right? So in all the tools, you end up with sets of sequence of convergent operators, right? Chef's an internal DSL, so you can actually evaluate this in its first pass and do some looping, and it'll actually spit out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 operators. But what you end up with here is basically just like this set of operations that end up being executed on the system every time, no matter what the tool, except for maybe, you know, isconf or something. But like, this is what we're working with here, like in our tool space. And again, they're always executed in a sequence. Whether or not you've explicitly defined the sequence or not, doesn't matter. But they do end up being executed on the system in a sequence. So there's that. And here's how Chef does it. So you end up with this thing called a run list that's applied to all of your nodes. That run list is a set of roles or other recipes. And then inside the recipes are the actual convergent operators, right? So we call them resources instead of promises and chef, but it's the same idea, right? They have a type, they have a name, they have an intention available under the hood. So a resource of type package has a set of intentions available saying, like, I'm going to install a package, I'm going to make sure it's uninstalled, I'm going to do whatever to it, right? So this is how we do it. And then we just, you assemble a run list, and then it walks a tree of roles and other run lists and spits out this at the bottom, which is just this flat set of sequence of resource and provider statements that it can take to the system. But what you're really doing here is this, right? So you're running a test and you're taking an action. So you're testing against the state of the system, taking an action to fix it if it's broken. Testing again, taking an action. Testing again. So you have this big long chain of tests. And we're finally going to give it to you, and we're calling it Y run mode instead of dry run mode. Well, that's what we're calling it now. Whether or not it actually ends up being called Y run mode in Chef 11 is still under debate. But so this is where people got addicted to dry run mode, was with make, right? Like, I can say make dash in, you know, my source code tree or whatever, and it would generate a list of the stuff that it would do to the system, and that was actually useful because it would actually do that, like, every time. It doesn't actually work like this in CM tools. So the best you can actually do with your CM tools, with a dry run mode or a no-op mode, is this. So I'm going to make a test and then not take any action. Make a test, not take any action. Basically, you're taking your operators and you're short-circuiting the second half of them and only running tests is what you're doing, basically. So let's look at, just for the sake of it, a couple chef recipes, right? So let's pretend we're in a baseline state here. So fresh operating system install. Okay, just pixie booted my Red Hat or whatever. Actually, this is Debian. And you say, all right, well, I'm going to run my tests, the test half of these operators. So in my imaginary dry run mode, I would say, OK, well, let me query the package manager. I don't see Apache 2 installed. Right, so my test failed, and I can tell you the action that I would take to fix it, right? So I'm going to install Apache 2. Well, you get down the line here, and you say, all right, well, I'm going to write this config file. Wait a minute. That enclosing directory doesn't actually exist. Well, OK, so as a test, I can say that the file doesn't exist, but I can't entirely be sure it's going to succeed. But I'm going to tell you I'm going to write it anyway. And then the service, what to do, it goes and queries the system services facility. I guess on Ubuntu it would be Upstart, and we've got systemd now, SMF and Solaris, system5 init scripts and older distros. But like that's not even available at all, right? So the test on this is going to say, well, not only can I not tell you if the service is running or not, because like the init script hasn't been installed from the package, but like I have no idea if it would succeed, right? I have no idea if this configuration file is valid, right? So somewhere in here is a little bit of dishonesty, but it's going to kind of tell you what it would think it would do anyway. That's not necessarily not disuseful, but OK. Let's look at a slightly more relevant example. So this is me installing a package repository. So I'm going to say, all right, well, let's write this configuration file to etc/apt. So I run the test. The test says, OK, well, that's not there yet. So I'm going to tell you that I will write it. And then I'm going to run this execute statement that actually goes and updates the app cache. And then the package statement actually subscribes to this. So when it changes, it'll execute. So what happens in a baseline system is this will actually end up working if the previous things will succeed. But in a dry run mode, you have no idea. Like, so the package update, for example, is a promise saying, like, I'm always going to make sure the latest version is available. So you can imagine in an imaginary dry run mode, like trying to actually make the output of this useful, it's going to go ahead and query your app cache and say, I have OHI version 0.0.1, but in a real run mode context, it's actually going to install OHI version 0.0.5 because the app cache has been updated in the intermediate step, right? So again, you're getting outputs from your tests and then different actual behavior during the course of a real run.
So your test is done.
Well, right, exactly, because the system is, yeah, exactly. So this is why we've been reluctant to actually do this for people. Look at this one. This one's a little bit more scary. I've actually seen this in a while. This isn't the best way to do this, but you know, whatever. So what we're doing here is we're saying, OK, install a package, write a config file. All right, well, let's mount this NFS directory. And the idea here was like, OK, well, I want to put a statement in that says clean up the underlying mount point before actually mounting it to kind of like reduce confusion when people actually walk into the directory. Well, during a dry run mode, this is going to say, I'll install a package if I need to. Okay, it'll say that this is not mounted, okay, and it'll say that to fix I need to mount it. This is an actual bug in the manifest because I probably meant to say file or template here instead of directory. But this is going to change its behavior depending on the state of this mount. So if the directory is mounted, you're going to get one behavior in your dry run mode output. If the directory is not, you're going to get a different behavior. And Scary town, right? So this one, pretend I'm actually trying to be Mr. Malicious Guy here, and like, you know, I'm, you know, hacking the Gibson, right? And my way to hack the Gibson is I'm going to update my chef policy, right? But it just so happens the plague's logged into this machine, and he's unmounted slash serve slash Gibson for some reason, right? So I run my dry run mode, right? It says, okay, the user's installed, okay, I'd fix that, okay. Well, that's not there, so I would actually change that and trigger this execute statement. Sweet. Update my policy, log out. The plague remounts the directory. Next time chef runs, I don't get my garbage file, and Ellison Mineral spills, you know, oil all over the coast, and, you know, bad guys win, and everybody's days ruined. Right? So don't want that. And the point is that the system actually changes in between the tests. So you have a sequence of these things. They're testing, taking action, testing, taking action, testing, taking action. And yeah, like the tests further down the chain could be completely different than what they would be at the initial state. Especially since you have things like I'm able to mount NFS shares, I'm able to mount Samba shares, I'm able to mount disks, I'm able to actually execute arbitrary statements in order to fix things, I can restart services, send signals to processes. All these things have the potential to affect the state of the system and then change the result of a test further down the line. Making dry run how useful again? So we've been very reluctant to actually do it. I made a graph. At first, I thought that maybe this would be like a line down the center, but it turns out that would imply science, and there's really no science happening here. This is pure, you know, good old-fashioned phenomenology here. So I put dots instead. So at a graph or at a system that's like 0% converged, like I know that the output of my dry run mode is probably going to be rather untrustworthy, if not complete and total bullshit, right? But towards the top here, like at a 100% or 99% converged system, okay, maybe I'm only gonna have a few things that are out of policy and I can actually trust them by actually looking at them and thinking as a human being, like, okay, that doesn't look like it'll take, you know, do anything silly, you know, whatever. So my usefulness for this feature is severely diminished by the fact that it needs to be way up here towards all the way converged anyway in order for it to actually be trustworthy. If that makes any sense. So there's that. And here's further considerations. So beyond just like the state of the file system and process tables, like you can actually make decisions about what to do based upon more dynamic aspects of the system. Like you could say like, all right, well, if I have more than a certain threshold of memory utilized, kill a process as an effort to converge the state back into a desired system. Well, that can actually change between runs without having to install any packages or do anything, right? In Chef and soon in Puppet, I'm not really sure about this, I'm not sure how this is handled in CF Engine, I'd be interested to ask. You have view of the wider infrastructure. So I can add another web server to my pool, and then the idea is next time my load balancer converges, it'll be able to find it, populate its config file, re-render the template, the checksum on that template has changed, so I notify the service to restart and automatically integrate it to the load balancer, or automatically integrate it into Nagios or whatever you're using for up-down monitoring, right? So between tests on a system, my external environment can actually change and affect the output of my dry run mode, or real run mode. So there's that. So what are we going to do about this? So the tact we've chosen to take is actually to publish our assumptions. So when we do go to make that directory, or I'm sorry, make that config file, like that's 9 directories deep off of the root, we're gonna say we'll assume that the enclosing directory exists and has been created by some earlier process that's happened on the system, right? So it kind of looks like this. This is the early mockup versions of it. We actually have real output now. It's actually working. It's coming out in the next release, but this is more readable, so I use these instead. And that's basically it. It's going to say, all right, well, desired state is installed, current state is not installed, here's what we would do to fix it. And then we're going to throw up gigantic capital letters in like red or whatever that says, warning, we're making assumptions here. So we're going to say, OK, well, we're going to assume that something actually installed a service definition for the service. We're going to assume that there's an init script. We're going to assume all these things. And then here, we're going to assume enclosing directories would have been created by some earlier thing. We're going to assume all this stuff. The point is that we want to communicate as much as possible the fact that this actually may not work when you run it, right? Here's notified, so you can chain up resources. So we'll say that we'll expect that an init script gets created. We'll expect, that nothing's going to blow up in the intermediary steps. Templates, we're going to show you diffs. This is interesting because let's say I'm diffing a file that doesn't exist yet. We're going to get a diff of the whole file, but further down the line in real run mode, there's a pretty good chance that a package dropped off a default version of this. So I'm going to get a different diff even in real run mode versus dry run mode. So there's that. So use cases. I've just showed you how dry run can lie to you and ruin your day, right? But we're making it anyway. So like, what are the actual valid use cases? So here's one that people actually want and is actually a valid use case. Verification. Right? I want to verify that my system is in compliance. It is it ends up being a, it passes all the tests, really, is what you're doing. You're saying green light, like Boolean in on all my tests on the first half of my actions, and I'm getting a yes or no answer. That's totally useful. You can actually ask the question, is my system in compliance? Is my system converged? Right. The other use case that everybody seems to want, and like this is when we answer the tickets, if you actually look through the thread, they want this. Right? This is when you say, why do you want dry run mode? The first thing that comes out of their mouth almost instinctually is this answer that says, I want to know what this policy would do to my system in production before I actually run it. That is the worst use case you could possibly come up with for this feature because it's the one that's the most dangerous. Right? So don't do that. So here's a cat. Back to the cats now. Here's another one. Have you guys seen these, the HTTP status cats? Pretty cool. You should check them out. Dry run mode is not a replacement for proper tests. So if you plan on using dry run mode in any tool, be it CF Engine, bconfig, 2, Puppet, Chef, or whatever, as a test on a production system to see if your code is going to be correct or not, you fail. So don't do it. Do proper tests. Converge it against like a node that's all the way set up. Converge it against the node that's at a baseline. Do something, but do not run code in production that you haven't tested in a staging environment. Okay, thank you very much. And then development workflows are another valid use case where you're saying, like, okay, I'm actually working on this stuff. And I know what my tool does, and I'm going to say, all right, let's see what this does, right? I've got a developer that's went around installing packages and things and edited files and Etsy and stuff. And I want to see if I'm going to make him lose his work that he just got done doing 5 seconds ago. Dry run mode is useful there, too. So we made it. We put it in. But my point is just be careful out there. Config management tools wield a lot of power, and they make your life a whole lot easier. And they allow us to tame complexity and actually make tractable the work that we're doing on the scales that we're doing it. But seriously, don't fuck it up. We're still operations people, at least I am. Well, it was in a previous life. Just be careful out there. So that's my slides. Any questions? None? Was it the cats?
Warning, 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 blah, 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 blah thing. Blah, 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 blah thing. Blah, blah, blah. I can't see what you're trying to tell me because there's way too much text. And I've found this in lots and lots of tools. You want to be helpful, but there's way too much text. The tools that I write have an explanation of, this is what I'm going to tell you. Now I'm telling you. For somebody who's brand new, that's useful. But when you're just trying to see what's going on, there's way too much noise. And picture, 1,000 words, blah, blah, blah. Why not a graph of stuff and the color or the shading or the hatching indicates what's assumed?
Yeah, well, this is like an actual screenshot of the real output. So we are doing that a little bit. So indentation and color just to help. But, you know, honestly, like, I'm not in the engineering team, so. But you know, this is our first pass at this, and we just wanted to make sure that we did it better than anybody. At least the first pass, and then maybe we can think about like graphing things and other more visual indicators further down the line. But at first, it was just, okay, how are we going to handle the problem? Aha, we'll publish our assumptions. Right.
Here we go. Dot notation would give you graphs with, I forget what the name of the tool is, that you know, puts all the circles and arrows.
Graph is.
That, with appropriate coloring, to me, would be much more usable for quick understanding. And then this is your detail information. Mm-hmm. The detail's important, but it can't be the only thing.
Right. Yeah, okay. I'll take that back.
Another thing that might be worth considering is, and the indentation is a tremendous help for that, Vim and other tools have folding mode, where you start with a folded version of your output, saying, here's what I would have done. And then when you unfold, here's what I assume on. And when you unfold, then there's all the warning text and so on. Yeah. I love the idea that you can't know, the admission of that.
Right.
But I'd also like to know what I would reasonably expect and be able to find it quickly.
Yeah. Okay.
Users. As a developer, I just want data readable formats, JSON, XML, whatever. So I really like the ideas. I also dislike dry run mode. I try not to use it. If I'm going to test things, you know, users either want syntax checking or they want staged environments for rollout to production. They don't really want dry run because they don't know what it really means and nobody does.
Right.
So I agree completely. I think this is great. But I do think that we should, referring back to my earlier talk, I think we should find out a common format that the various tools can agree on, and then we can all produce the same output that other people can look at for compliance reporting.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be somewhere in here, right? I mean, like, you got to get it down to this kind of atomic idea. If we're going to try to come up with something.
Right? Yep. So. I think it'll be, I think that's a great area for collaboration.
So one of the things I was really struck by in your talk is that we don't really have this issue anywhere near as seriously as everything that I'll broadly classify as in the CF engine family, right? Because there's a big sort of family tree there. And so I started thinking about why that is, and part of it is we retest really aggressively during the deployment process. And so that allows us to figure out when things have changed and we need to backtrack.
Yeah.
Right? And we also gang operations together. And so basically what ends up happening is sort of an all-at-once evaluation of what the pre-existing state is.
Yeah.
Figuring out what your actions are going to be and then knowing which of those actions are likely to result in downstream invalidations or whatever. And and while of course things can change and operations can interact with one another. And most importantly, the underlying tools can fail in horrific and awful ways. Mm-hmm. Yum, I'm looking at you.
Right.
The thing that we found in practice is that dry run mode actually fills a really important cognitive role for people that are interacting with the system, because once you end up with a configuration that's not a toy configuration,
right,
frequently you end up in the situation where not everybody understands all the configuration. And something is needed there, right? And it's I think that the only way that you could solve the problem with the sort of robustness that you're looking for is have a dry run, single commit at a time sort of mode where it goes through and says, okay, I've got these 50 predicates that are all failing, and I'm going to have to do all these things, so I'm going to pick one, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, I'm going to you know, then maybe do it, and then I'm going to move on to the next one, and then at least you could tell reliably. But I think that putting big caveats around a dry run mode and telling people not to use it is probably a short-sighted sort of solution.
Well, I mean, it's not that we're going to tell people not to use it. As a matter of fact, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to be like, yay, we finally made it, you know, like, here you go, you know. So, like, I agree with you. That cognitive, like, glue in there, like, the fact that people are going to be able to see this and be like, oh, the package isn't installed, you know what I mean? That's going to help out tremendously. And then in a testing kind of, like, we spend a lot of time talking about testing the past year, like, how to actually do it, because it's kind of a hard problem, right? Like, what do you test? And we have a tool that's testing all sorts of things at an atomic level.
Well, you know, I think this is something that is a you have less introspection capabilities when you've got a language that has, you know, complicated conditionals in it, mm-hmm, right? And so the approach that we took is that we encapsulated all that stuff within a relatively small box, right? So we've got templates that can have conditional logic in them, and mm-hmm, and those exist in a couple of well-defined places in the system. But by and large, things fit into a very static pattern. And that, okay, that allows us to actually understand what's going on a lot better. I think that this is... having too much flexibility means that you can't actually tell people what they're going... You know, what the code that they're writing that's relatively abstract, powerful code is going to do. I mean, we were talking last night about how there are a lot of tricks that you can't play when you're talking about the Ruby interpreter, because the language is so powerful, right? Yeah. And so you just can't optimize very much. And it feels like much the same sort of thing.
I mean, it's a trade-off made from, like, so with an external DSL, you get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You get to do static analysis, right? With an internal DSL, you cannot, because you've got, you know, like, so static, possible, static, possible, static, impossible, right? Because, like, this could... I could in here, and as a matter of fact, I do this all the time, stick a search line in here that says, give me an array of the IP addresses for all my, like, you know, worker nodes or something.
Sure.
And then, so, like, it's really hard to do that. You can actually make arbitrary, like, calls to databases and stuff and just,
sure,
get information to actually feed into the resource statement. So it's, like, how, I wouldn't even know where to begin even thinking about how to, like, analyze that in that way. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the more complicated cases end up being, well, complicated, right?
Yeah.
But the trick, I think, is to try to encapsulate the places where the complicated things need to happen, as opposed to saying whole hog, everything has the potential for being complicated,
yeah,
right? And it's not easy, right? And I'm not actually saying that we made the right choices with bconfig, but we made an interesting different choice,
yeah,
and it has a bunch of different trade-offs. Is the major point, I think.
Cool. Yeah, and then, like, the added difficulty with testing is, like, systems of convergent operators actually have interesting behavior when you apply them repeatedly. Like, sometimes they'll stabilize and sometimes they won't, and it's just, you know, like, lots of work to do, lots of things to figure out. We're nowhere near being done here, so. Cool. All right, well, I guess I'm done then. Thank you.